On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Disneyland Paris opened its gates, a French director memorably called the arrival of Mickey Mouse in Europe a cultural Chernobyl. When Michael Eisner launched Euro Disney on the Paris Stock Exchange, he was pelted with eggs. But now, out of Paris comes a big new art exhibit making a European claim on, of all things, the roots of Disney magic. Not on Mickey exactly, or Steamboat Willie, but in the early, classic Disney features, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Pinocchio, and more, here's a celebration of Gothic architecture, of painters, Pre-Raphaelite, German Romantic, Flemish, and of the notion of Walt Disney himself as artist. Up next, On Point, hi-ho, Europe, art history, and Disney. Joining me now from Montreal is Bruno Girvaux. He is senior curator of the exhibit Once Upon a Time Walt Disney, the sources of inspiration for the Disney Studios, opening today at the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts after a five-month run in Paris. Bruno Girvaux, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Also with us from Los Angeles is Charles Solomon. He's a critic and historian of animation, author of The Disney That Never Was and Enchanted Drawings, The History of Animation. He's seen the new Disney exhibit in Paris and wrote two essays for the exhibition's catalog. Charles Solomon, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Salut, Bruno.
Hi, Charles. It's nice to hear you.
Old pals, meeting over Disney, Bruno Girvaux. Okay, Disney out of Paris, that seems like such a clash of everything right there. I read in the Independent, I mean, here you are, a kind of great wise man of art, and the Independent out of London said last fall, you know, the question occurs is why Girvaux is doing this apparently suicidal thing of bringing Disney to Paris when a simple revolver to the head might achieve the same end.
Yeah. I'm still alive. So.
Congratulations.
Yes, no.
What are you up to here?
Yes, actually, it was right in a way, because it was not so easy to convince people, I mean people from our from the cultural circle, French cultural circle, that we could do an exhibition about Walt Disney. Because Walt Disney, especially in Europe and especially in France, is mostly considered as a paragon of the American cultural and economic imperialism. Mm. And so it's difficult for many people to reconsider Walt Disney as an artist. So that's what was meaning the article of the Independent, that it was really at the very beginning of the conception of the exhibition. It was really difficult to convince people to do the exhibition.
A brave thing,
but at
maybe.
Least I managed to. We have managed
survived.
To do it in the Grand Palais, the most important
yes.
place for the French exhibitions.
Charles Solomon, you saw it in Paris starting today. A lot of people will see it in Montreal. I wish you'd just begin to give us a sense of the kind of juxtapositions here. I've seen the big catalog, and it's wonderful. These images from Disney pulled out of the classic movies are quite something to see in still form, but then to see them put by what's described as European sources of inspiration is really striking, in spite of the fact that we know where castles and princes come from. I mean, I'm looking at one right off the bat here. It's a scene of the Seven Dwarfs. House, their cottage in the woods from 1937 Snow White. And then next to it, they have Bruegel's Return from the Inn, 1620 Oil and Tempura. It's something held by the Montreal Museum there. And the shape, the design, the architecture, the attitude seems so evident in the Disney right next to it. How closely aligned are these?
Well, they're actually quite close, and the prejudice that Bruno was referring to is that animation has always been treated as kind of the unloved red-haired stepchild of both film and the graphic arts, when the artists of Disney, and that still applies today, but particularly during this golden era under Walt himself, were the real heirs to the Renaissance tradition of fine draftsmanship, of putting lines on paper in a way that suggests form and mass and attitude and perspective and light and expression. Mm. And so most of those artists were very well trained from art school, as were the designers. One of the principal designers of Snow White was Albert Herder, who I believe was Swiss, and who certainly would have known the work of Bruegel and the other artists of that, you know, influenced these films, just as many of the other top animators did. Mm.
But Bruno Girvo, there they were, sitting in Los Angeles, drawing frame after frame, a long way from Europe. If Europe is down in the roots of Disney magic, how did it get there?
Oh, for the very, not the very first time, but second time you went to Europe, it was in 1935. And at this time, he had in mind, and he have already began the conception of Snow White and Seven Dwarfs. And he went to Paris, and he had a journey around Europe for more than 11 weeks. And he was there to receive a medal from the Société des Nations, the League of Nations.
Because something and I didn't know, he had actually been an ambulance driver in World War I, Walt Disney, too young to serve in the military, but drove an ambulance.
Yes.
And even then, he lied about his age to do it.
Right. So he was back to get a medal, but brought home a lot more than a medal, Bruno.
Yes, right. He took the opportunity to be there to buy all around Europe in bookshops more than 350 books, 350 illustrated books of the 19th and the 20th century. And among these books were all the important illustrated books by Gustave Doré, by the Frenchman Gustave Doré and Honoré Daumier, but also illustrated book from England and some illustrated by Master Arthur Rackham, but also German illustrated books. So more than 350 books both there and brought back to California. And it was it's the heart, it's the very beginning of the studio, of the Walt Disney Studios library. And all these books help the Disney artists to find an iconography for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but also the following movies. So it's the beginning of the link between Walt Disney and Europe.
So it's partly in a load of illustrations brought back from Europe. I should say, by the way, at our website, you can see a lot of the images from the new Montreal exhibit, Once Upon a Time Walt Disney, at onpointradio.org. You can see some of these side-by-side images that suggest very strongly where Disney images, whether it's villains or monsters or Tinkerbell or cottages and woods, where they drew their inspiration. Bruno, I hear you there.
I should add something that we can see all these books because we found them in the current at the Walt Disney Imagineering. We found the books brought back by Walt Disney, so we can see the real books in the exhibition in Montreal.
Charles?
With the checkout cards, with in some cases Walt's name on them.
Right.
One of Disney's principal artists, the head of what he called his character model department, that was kind of the story and stylistic R&D, was Joe Grant, who had been a caricaturist for some of the Hearst papers and the Chicago Tribune, and whose father had been one of the art directors for William Randolph Hearst. And he had learned about these artists from his father and urged Walt. I suspect he and Albert Herder and a few of the other artists basically gave Walt a shopping list and said, this is what we need. And Walt himself had, you know, was not a complete bumpkin. He had gone to art school and had earned a living for a time as a caricaturist and animator and graphic artist.
But he was also using the talents of an awful lot of immigrant illustrators who were part of that early studio design team.
Oh, yes, very much so. People like Gustav Tengren, Kai Nielsen, the great Swedish illustrator, Albert Herder. There was a whole series of talents that came to Disney because during the Depression, it was a place to get a job. it was a place where their work could be appreciated. And already Disney was one of the most famous people in the world, and the Disney studio in the 30s was someplace every intellectual wanted to go to and just see what was happening. How did they create Mickey Mouse?
And yet when you look at Mickey Mouse and Steamboat Willie, the very early Disney things, you don't have that sense of Europe flooding before your eyes. It's when he goes to the big Technicolor full features, Snow White and all the rest, that Europe just springs to the fore, Bruno.
Yes. Before Snow White and Seven Dwarfs, all the silly symphonies was a kind of laboratory for the next future film. But actually, Snow White and Seven Dwarfs was the one of the first full-length animated movie, and in this film, it's a kind of catalog of, as Fantasia later, a kind of catalog of European influences.
Let's bring the images to mind with a little sound from one of those very Euro early Disney films.
Oh, Figaro, look! Look, the wishing star! Starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. I wish I might have the wish I make tonight. Figaro, you know what I wish? I wish that my little Pinocchio might be a real boy. Wouldn't that be nice? Just think, a real boy.
A real boy, and Geppetto's off with it in Pinocchio. We're joined in this hour by Bruno Girvo. He's curator of the exhibit. Once Upon a Time, Walt Disney, the sources of inspiration for the Disney Studios, got it mounted in Paris. Now he's overseeing it at the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts and joins us from Montreal. Charles Solomon is with us from Los Angeles, a critic and animation historian there, wrote some essays for the catalog on this wonderful exhibit. And now from Los Angeles as well, we're joined by Ron Barbagallo, he's animation art historian, director of animation art conservation, and animation art advisor for Animation Magazine, and personal conservator for Roy Disney, Walt Disney's nephew. Ron Barbagallo, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
So I guess it's no surprise to you that we've got all these deep roots. I mean, take Pinocchio, for example. We're reading here about its sources very specific and set in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, this exhibition is long overdue thematically. I mean, there's such strong elements of European folklore in the artwork and in the fairy tales that I kind of applaud France for getting on board and doing this now.
I wonder if you can take us into some of the how it happened here. That Disney, we read about him going to Europe, traveling there, bringing back the sketchbooks. We're hearing about his Swedish and Swiss and right on down the line illustrators. But is it your sense that Walt Disney, you know, out of Missouri, was consciously drawing on these sources?
Maybe more subconsciously, because you got to remember, in the United States, the largest immigration group would be in around 1905, 1906. So the children of these European immigrants would have been growing up in the 1910s, studying the kind of art that their parents would have been familiar with, which would have been European art and European fairy tales. And whether they were consciously aware of it or subconsciously, I think it just fed into the greater subconscious in the way that they work. So when they were hired by the Disney Company, it wasn't because they were great cartoonists or great animators. It was because they were aspiring artists trained with a European aesthetic.
Charles Solomon, Walt Disney was setting out to capture the American imagination in a new way, or at least that's what he ended up doing. Was it the sense in those days that fantasy, the realm that he worked so effectively in, that fantasy itself was somehow European?
I don't know that fantasy itself was European. I mean, there's the American tradition of people like Edgar Allan Poe, but he was drawing very much on European stories and fairy tales. Snow White is a very familiar fairy tale, which he saw a live-action film of while a paperboy in Kansas City. Pinocchio is a long, drawn-out, not terribly interesting serial by a writer who wrote under the name of Carlo Collodi. And what Disney understood about these fantasies, though, and probably instinctually, because he trusted his gut reaction very much, is that these were fantasies that touched people, and if they were presented in the proper way, they were moving and compelling stories. When they were beginning Snow White one evening at the studio soundstage, he told the story to the key artists, taking on the parts of the different characters. And one of the artists I knew who was there for that performance said that we would have climbed a mountain of wildcats to make that movie after Walt's performance. We didn't know it was impossible.
And off they went. But yet, you know, you wonder, I'm looking here, Bruno, in the exhibit, in the catalog here, you've got this, here's Jiminy Cricket, straight out of Pinocchio. And then on the facing page, it's a wonderful illustration from Granville, 1842. Yeah. And you've got a very similar looking cricket among anthropomorphic crickets, sort of dancing with turtles and snails, all very kind of human in their approach. And I must say, this cricket looking a lot like Jiminy Cricket. An accident that it shows up 70 years later in a Disney film?
No, it's not an accident. The books you're talking about, it's a book illustrated by Jean-Jacques Granville, one of the most famous illustrators of the first part of the 19th century, was in the studio library, was bought by Walt Disney himself and read by Walt Disney himself. So it's not a coincidence. And the book and the exhibition is the one bought by Walt Disney. And Granville, or Walt Disney was very interested in Granville and also in Doré because he was the first in the 19th century to anthropomorphize animals. So it was quite interesting for Walt Disney to adapt these Granville's characters, but he turned it in its own way, of course, because it looks like that it's completely different. And also the adaptation from the novel by Carlo Collodi is completely different. The Disney version is completely different than the original novel.
Or Ron Barbagallo, I'm looking here at another. Here's a more familiar to many Americans, maybe, Beatrix Potter, 1895. And it's a pumpkin carriage drawn by three pairs of, in this case, rabbits. Cinderella's carriage is the inscription on the back, going to fetch her from the ball intended for moonlight. And this pumpkin carriage, wow, does it look like Disney's. Accident, same story, and so it shows up the same way? Or is this, again, a close reading of work across the pond?
Yeah, I think it's a very smart way to sort of pay homage to the European fairy tales, in this case a French fairy tale, by attributing European artists in their work. You know, it's their point of reference, you know, and I think it helps make the films accessible to an American audience, since at the time so many Americans were of European ancestry. You know, I think it's a way to sort of connect the two.
Charles, this issue of what's fantasy, I'm still pondering on, because, of course, you could set fantasy in any setting. It could be Paul Bunyan, you know, it could be the American West, it could be New York, and all of these have been over time. But those early sort of seminal Disney films, so European. When you're in the forest, it feels like a European forest. You see a hunter, it looks like a European hunter. You get queens and princes and, above all, castles. And I still wonder, was he tapping something that was untapped at that point, sort of reviving European iconography in a way that Americans of that time flocked to?
Well, Americans would certainly have known book illustrations by the Europeans, by American illustrators. But drawing on those fairy tales, those are the settings you need. And I think Disney had a sense of sort of what was a Platonic version of a castle, that if you see a castle, you expect it to have certain features, and he would put his artists to work discerning those and weeding those out of the other elements. You know, a very clear example of that is Sleeping Beauty's castle, which is quite clearly based on an illustration in a 15th century French Book of Hours. And Ivan Earle, who designed a lot of that film, did that very deliberately. The French illuminators, Van Eyck, and some other artists of that period were influences on his own painting and graphic work. So when he went to work on Sleeping Beauty, that's what he looked to. And that carries through even to the colors. You'll see the same yellow-green and rose-pink and a deep cerulean blue originally made from ground lapis lazuli, runs all through Sleeping Beauty as it does through that great Book of Hours.
Ron Barbagallo, you point back to, of course, this setting the colors, whether it's in Disney or Da Vinci or Turner, the first task to decide that basic palette, and Disney picking up some palettes very much evident in Old Masters.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember that after the Renaissance, there was this sense of narrative that was added to everything, not just the way the figures were grouped or posed or the expressions on their face or a sense to tell a story, but also in its use of color. I mean, in a lot of ways, the colors were used to focus you. A local color would go down first over a detailed drawing or maybe even a rough drawing, and then umbers, siennas, browns would go down to sort of suggest light and shadow and give you a focal point. And then in Snow White, you see this quite clearly, that the colors of the forest backgrounds become the color palette by which we extrapolate the colors of the dwarves, the greens, the browns, the ochres, or a little bit more saturated. And then when we get to Snow White, she's actually the most saturated colors, with the royal blue of her bodice and the red of her lips.
Mm-hmm. Charles?
To jump in for a minute there, one of the things that the Disney artists would do for each of the features is prepare what they called a color script, where they would go through the storyboards and the scenario for the film and determine what would be the predominant colors in each sequence and the way they would make transitions from one to the other, depending on the emotions and the settings that were part of that sequence and what needed to be communicated.
Mm. Mm. Bruno, I hear you there.
May I add something?
Yes, please.
That all these artists, the European immigrants as well as the American-born artists were all trained in Europe, in academies, in a school of art, and they had all of them had a huge technical mastery coming from the academic way of painting and drawing. So it's also explained the links between the Walt Disney Studios and Europe. For instance, Charles was talking about Eivind Earle working on Sleeping Beauty. He trained in France and he spent the bulk of his childhood with his father in France, in the south of France, and he knew very well French Gothic, and that's the reason why he had chosen to pick up an element from the Book of Hours. And all the Disney artists were like Earl. We have quoted Herter, but also Tangreen, and even American-born artists such as Joy Grant were fond of European and art and literature.
These illustrators may be working in Burbank, but a whole world behind them. Let's begin to turn to our listeners from Durham, Connecticut. Michael's calling. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. What do you know?
Well, I think that it's important to recognize that although Walt depended on the European traditions for his inspiration, that initially he was viewed as a renegade and a heretic.
By whom? By whom, Michael?
My father-in-law, Carl Hauenstein, was the head of Otis Art Institute in Los Angeles, where Disney trained.
Mm.
And when Disney approached him with his idea of an animation studio, my father-in-law had the wisdom to throw him out of the office.
Oops.
Animation was not considered an art form or of any interest to a traditional artist at that time in the early 30s before Mickey Mouse.
So he was renegade in looking at animation as a potential source of feature films, but renegade in his choice of images, in the motifs, and maybe some of the European influence, or not?
Well, his choice of medium was considered too plebeian and was not of interest in other words, among the titled experts of European tradition, they didn't view Walt as carrying on their tradition, even though the current exhibition shows that he he did in his own way.
Right. Many decades later, Bruno Girvo, as I recall, you describe a scene where Walt Disney is in Paris, and as I recall this, he sees a sequence of his own short animated films back to back in a Paris theater, and from that says, you know, maybe we could do a feature film, a long single film based in animation.
Yes, he had already the idea to do Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and he was working on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but this moment convinced him that he was in the right way.
To jump in there for a moment,
yes.
Remember all the great silent comics whom Disney knew and admired very much, Buster Keaton and Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy, had all gone from shorts to features because there was much more prestige and potentially much more money there.
Yes.
That shorts did not get much respect and didn't get much in the way of rentals. But although your caller's father-in-law would have nothing to do with them at Otis, fortunately, Mrs. Chouinard, who ran the Chouinard Art Institute in Los Angeles, understood what Walt was trying to do and helped provide training for his animators to gear them up for the enormous challenge that Snow White represented. You know, a few of the artists like Grim Natwick and Bill Tytla, who animated Snow White herself and Grumpy, had studied in Europe. But many of these artists needed more training in draftsmanship to be able to draw such realistic characters. And Disney basically turned his studio into an art school, using the profits from Mickey Mouse merchandise to pay for the classes.
And here are the classes that I'm getting in going through the catalog. I mean, illustration after illustration of Snow White-style princess laid out in the forest. Not Disney's, predating Disney, but lots and lots of that kind of image that clearly Walt Disney drew on. Let's get a sound of some of that Disney in our ears. Suddenly a fairy shows up here. Wendy, John, and Michael discover Tinkerbell for the first time in Peter Pan.
Oh, look, a firefly.
A pixie.
Amazing.
What's the pixie doing?
Talking.
What did she say?
She says you're a big, ugly girl.
Oh, well, I think she's lovely.
Well, come on, Wendy. Let's go.
A pixie, a fairy, and lots of pixie and fairy art that may have been drawn from. We'll talk about it. I want to go to our listeners first. Reginald is calling from Denmark, South Carolina. Hi, Reginald. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm a lifelong Disney collector. I'm an early childhood professional, too, but I'm a big fan of the old black and white cartoons and the Philly symphonies. And the one thing that I've noticed is that Disney had a very good eye toward the future, because his cartoons are very accessible now. Unlike Bugs Bunny and Woody Woodpecker, his cartoons are for the family, and the other cartoons for the other students. So they took too much of an adult edge, and that's why they're edited so much in television. But Disney really saw the need to make his cartoons, especially during the early years, very whimsical, very accessible, and very very much a timeless thing. And it's a shame that they don't have that same perspective now. It's more commercialized. But back then, it was so whimsical and so artistically influenced and really reflects the fluidity that Europe had.
Reginald, you're breaking up on us, but I think we've got the sentiment there very clearly, and thanks for the call. Let me get one more here from Somerville, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I was wondering if your guest thought that somehow Walt Disney's genius or innovation is diminished after coming to the realization that so much of his work was modeled after European artists.
Let's take it straight to them. Bruno Girvo, you're the curator. What do you say?
I do not understand the question.
Does it take anything away from Disney's innovation, from his genius? And it's a word you use as well, that his work was so often modeled on European tradition.
No. And no, there's. I think that Walt Disney was a genius, and the European source of inspiration are just a material. It's just something that he could transform and could move into his own art. And I must say that The exhibition is the point of view of the curators, and it's based on the book published by Robin Allen, written in 1999, and it's about the Walt Disney and Europe. But we could also take example of self-inspiration in American art. For instance, all the first sequence in the Disney classics are a bird-eyed view, an overview. For instance, the overview of the village of Geppetto in Pinocchio is although
a bird's eye looking down from as if from the clouds.
Yes. Also, it was directly inspired by a Bavarian city of the Middle Ages. It's also directly inspired by paintings of Grant Wood and Thomas Art Benton, American regionalist painters. So there is also some American sources, and the Walt Disney actually had was a genius, and because it was. It was a personal way to adapt the European sources.
It's a particular era of his work that you're focused on here, mainly in the 1930s. Bruno Gervaux, why did you choose these particular films? There was, of course, the famous time later when, was it during World War II, when his illustrators went on strike, when Disney got in financial trouble, when he withdrew from being so directly involved himself. But describe for us which films in particular you're focused on around this theme.
We have we decided the curators and I to focus on the films directly supervised by Walt Disney himself, from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in 1937 until The Jungle Book in 1967. Because these are the masterpiece of the Walt Disney Company.
But at the heart of it, you've got there the Fantasia, Sleeping Beauty, a Snow White.
Yes. You mean why we have focused on these early movies? Or?
Well, I guess we can see it pretty clearly. That's where
the European influence are the strongest.
Clearly,
yes,
clearly.
In the early Disney classic,
right.
Snow White, Pinocchio, and Fantasia.
We'll look at some more of those influences. Let me go to Chris in Boston. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
How do you do, Tom?
Very well. What do you see, Chris?
As a person who was raised with Disney, and I'm an African-American person who was also Native American.
Yes.
I find that the theme, the European theme that Disney has is hegemony, where it seems as if his racialization of characters, like in characters in Song of the South, or Main Street USA in Disneyland during the 60s, sort of flew in the face of urban cosmopolitan life and grandized this sort of manifest destiny of European hegemony in this country.
Chris, may I ask you on that point? You're talking there about some racial characterizations in Disney animation, but what about simply this kind of European focus of the early ones? Does that in itself look like a kind of cultural hegemony from your African-American perspective?
Well, having just returned from Europe and being in Holland, I feel as though it's a grandized view. My experience in Europe was very open and people were very welcoming, and the feeling that I get from watching a Disney film or being at Disneyland is very much quite the opposite.
Chris, yes, please, Ron. Chris, thanks for your call.
If you look at European painting in the 1500s, 1600s, on up to probably the 19th century, you're going to see pretty much the same depiction of African Americans or Africans in general in European painting that you would see within Walt Disney's films. I mean, you need to look at Disney in the same context you would Hans Christian Andersen, the Brothers Grimm, or Charles Dickens, because, well, his medium was motion picture. Those writers were, for their times, the storytellers, and Walt was a storyteller.
Charles?
He'd only work with his own point of reference.
Mm-hmm. Charles, Solomon?
Yes, well, two things I think you have to be aware of are, one, what historians call presentism, where we try and project contemporary values or expectations on figures from the past, which can only give you a distortion. And secondly, the Disney studio actually does much less in the way of racial imagery in their films than most of the other Hollywood studios do. For example, Walter Lantz had characters. A character was called Lil 8-Ball. There was Bosco and Honey and MGM and other characters that today we see as, you know, very much ethnic stereotypes. And Disney generally avoided that.
What about looking, there's the ethnic stereotype question, but just this bigger question of Disney fantasy as a kind of Euro nostalgia for the sons and daughters of Europe in this country. Was there a kind of fundamental whiteness about Disney? I guess you'd have to say there is.
Well, he was Caucasian.
But I mean, even in his whole notion, was this an exercise in Americans looking back to the old country that got people so excited in these early years of Disney?
I think that was part of it, but I think it was also America at that time, at least the dominant culture in America, was Eurocentric. The population was less diverse ethnically, and there were fewer ethnic voices than we have today. So I think the works reflect that just as they reflect their times. You don't see black dancers in Busby Berkeley's chorus lines. I don't think you could really expect to see them, that one of the seven dwarves would be African-American or Native American.
Yeah, certainly, I'm guessing Chris's folks were there in that great population, too. Let me get a call from North Reading, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. Great show. Love Disney. I'm just still astounded at the pace at which Disney went from the early Steamboat Willie stuff to those very sophisticated animations, even in the first films, and then all the way up to things like the multi-plane camera and so forth. Were all these homegrown technologies, or did his artists bring a lot of this technique with them? Because, you know, even today you don't see animation of the quality that you saw back then.
That's a great question. Let me put it to you, Ron Barbagallo in L.A. It does seem like such an amazing leap from Steamboat Willie to those first feature-length films with all that lushness and depth. How did that happen?
You know, I guess it's Walt's enthusiasm, really. I mean, he's so intoxicating as a storyteller, and for the team of artists that he grouped around him, I guess we're so maybe really under his spell artistically that they just wanted to please him so much. So whenever there were new techniques that were needed to be created, you know, even in the paint lab, let alone in the camera work, these guys just stepped up and delivered things like the effects on the snowflakes in the Nutcracker Suite in Fantasia, or the multiplane camera used to enter Geppetto's workshop. I mean, even the dry brush techniques that are used to paint the cells, I think you got to look towards the leader. I mean, in a lot of ways, if Stokowski conducted the orchestra for Fantasia, Walt conducted the studio.
And they were painting each of these, which is an amazing idea, frame by frame.
Yeah, they really are handcrafted watercolor paintings in the European sense. You don't see that today with all the digital coloring.
Charles?
Well, some of the cells that Ron was talking about, of the frost fairy skating on the lake in the Nutcracker, took like 6 hours a piece to ink and paint.
Wow.
They're so intricate.
Wow.
But Disney was also willing to underwrite that training and technology, which is one reason the studio was able to make those incredible leaps. Remember, only a dozen years separate Fantasia and Steamboat Willie.
Yeah.
And he sent his artists to school and would pay to do new things and try new things. And as Bruno mentioned, he used the Silly Symphonies as a laboratory and kind of R&D studio to get the effects he wanted. If you look on the DVDs you can get now at The Goddess of Spring and then The Cookie Carnival, you can see the artist learning how to draw a real, believable feminine heroine towards Snow, you know, so who would eventually have to animate Snow White.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one is rubbery-limbed and very unconvincing and looks a bit like Mary Pickford. But a year later, the Sugar Cookie Girl in the Cookie Carnival, she's suddenly becoming solid and really feminine and much more believable. And so he could use the shorts that way to build to the features, but he was willing to spend the money and take the risks, you know, on both Steamboat Willie and Snow White and Cinderella. He literally risked every nickel he had. Had any of those flopped, it would have been the end of his studio.
I have to say, looking back in these images, I remain amazed, though, at some of these sources, and I don't know how direct it is, but there's the famous scene, Bruno, that, of course, from The Sorcerer's Apprentice, where you've got Mickey sweeping up down in a kind of underground arena, down a strange, curvy passageway. Then you've got an image here from a 1914 film, Der Gollum, from Paul Wegener and Heinrich Galeen, with a very, very similar cave-like entrance to an underground cell and the golem coming down. Do we know? Was this just from Disney's unconscious, or had he seen this film?
No. All the comparison of the exhibition are documented. The scene you're talking about in The Sorcerer's Apprentice is actually directly inspired by the golem and, generally speaking, by all the early German expressionist movies. So it means the golem, but also the German movie maker Murnau for the Faust, released in 1926, which is another influence for The Sorcerer's Apprentice, but also Fritz Lang and Metropolis. And it's not a coincidence, because we know that Walt Disney has hired a movie theater in Hollywood and told to his collaborators to see movies, of course, Hollywood movies, but also German expressionist film. And we have some memories from, for instance, from Mark Davies, one of the animators, who told that he saw all the movies by Fritz Lang, by Murnau, and was very impressed by them. And so there is a real link between this cinema, even if it's unexpected.
There's so many great images here. Ron, I'm looking at one. 1886, John Atkinson Grimshaw, of a beautiful fairy above a sylvan pond. And then right next to it, there's Tinkerbell. These fairies are cousins, clearly. I mean, fantasy kept alive for the great public.
It's all the sort of symbolism that you would see in spoken fairy tales that became written fairy tales of Europe. Not just fairies, but, you know, if you look back into European painting, there's a wonderful painting called The Nightmare, done by John Henry Fuseli, that has a horse with glowing eyes that peers between a curtain with a little nymph sitting by a woman that's just like reclining. I mean, it's all this sense of, I guess I would call it forest drama, you know, the other world. It isn't what's in your cottage, it's in what's outside your cottage. And that's a very European environment, the forest, the cottage. It's not bamboo, it's not Australia, it's certainly not the Arctic, it's Europe.
But we didn't even get to Bambi, which where the influences are much more Asian, as you point out, Bruno. Just it's a tremendous journey here through European art history, American references, and the stills from Disney. I'm really glad that it's been pulled together. The exhibit is opening today in Montreal. How long will it run, Bruno?
I think it will last until the end of June.
Montreal Museum of Fine Arts with Once Upon a Time, Walt Disney. Just a terrific tour. Bruno Gervo, curator there, thank you for all your work on this, and thanks for your time today. Good luck with the exhibit. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Tom. Ron Barbagallo in L.A., personal conservator to Roy Disney, animation art historian. Ron, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. And Charles Solomon, just great having you, Charles. We appreciate your time and insights today. Your book, Once Upon a Time, The Disney That Never Was. Charles, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
We'll go out with, well, you know what it is. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.